Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. That initial noise on there, I'm going, what kind of scratching noise is that? That was simply applause for Judy Garland. I'm playing some selections from her famous concert at Carnegie Hall. I have in the studio Ann Jonzos, who will be on at 9:30 to talk about her what I think is a fascinating book, Potty Mouth, Big Thoughts from Little Mons Minutes. Seemed like a deep title, but it's a very interesting book on a lot of levels. And Ann is sitting in here because she is a journalist. And we're on the phone with another journalist, a woman named Michelle Carter, who has written what I think is a fascinating, somewhat funny, but to my mind, welcome to the show, too, Michelle. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
It makes me angry, your book, a little, in that you went to Russia, and we'll get in deeply into it. You went to Russia at a time when there seemed a lot of hope in Russia for freedom of the press. And, you know, you just look at the state of affairs now and it breaks my heart. It is a long way, Michelle Carter, from San Mateo, where you were a writer and an editor, to Moscow. How did you make that leap?
Well, it wasn't as though I just one day up and decided that
exactly,
I was going to
right.
go spend a year in Russia.
Very few people do that.
Yes. Well, I had been traveling and writing about Russia since for about 8 years before I got the invitation to spend a year as journalist in residence for the United States Information Service, or Information Agency, as it was called then.
Mm-hmm.
My brief was simple. I was supposed to. My intention was to be a midwife for the for a free press in Russia. I was supposed to work with newspaper editors across the 11 time zones of this massive country. I visited more than 30 cities in that year. So it was. You mentioned that it made you angry. You have no idea how angry it makes me.
Oh, I cannot even imagine. Yeah, there must have been. Take me back a little. You had written a book before you went
right.
to Russia called Children of Chernobyl, Raising Hope from the Ashes in 1993. How did you get involved with that project?
It started with an exchange between a church group here and the Soviet Peace Committee in 1988. So we're still in the Soviet period.
Sure.
I went in 1988, went again in 1990. And in 1990, the wheels were coming off the Soviet Union. There were protesters in the streets. And as a journalist, it was pretty cool.
No question.
I was, interviewing and so forth. So they wanted to get us out of there. And so they sent us to Minsk, the backwater capital of Belarus. And it was there I met the doctor who has dedicated her life to treating the children who were affected by the explosion and meltdown.
So funny, Minsk, the ancestral home of my father's side of the family. That's where both my grandfather and grandmother emigrated to the United States from that charming, I'll call it a charming city. Your career in journalism was a very, very, very solid one. I would have had you, if were I in charge of the United States Information Agency, to send you over to try to nurture Russian journalists. That was indeed your mission, was it not, to try to infuse them with a sense of freedom of the press? True?
Well, you have to understand first that we were giddy during that period.
Well, I'll bet.
We absolutely believed that that this, of course, was the turning point. The Cold War was over. We were going to go forward. My task was to share this enthusiasm for a free press, an open press, a non-subsidized press. to tell them how you get information from authorities that don't want you to have it. How do you write a story that people want to read? How do you create pages that build circulation? How do you sell advertising?
Wow,
which is pretty
sure.
Basic stuff.
But, in dealing with the editors with whom you dealt and the papers with whom you dealt, it almost would be like teaching someone who has been bedridden for their entire lives to start walking, in essence. Now, I'm not trying to romanticize it. Your book, though, you're from
no,
under.
But you're,
is that part of it? I mean, they must have not had basically clueless. I mean, it's sort of starting to walk, yes?
Well, it certainly was in practice. In theory, they knew, these were professional journalists in the sense that they had studied journalism. They knew how it worked in the rest of the world, but they had never practiced it in that fashion.
Where did most of it, to generalize, and much of the information is In your charming and incisive book, and there is, somehow you found some humor in your time in Russia too. Yeah, I know, but From Under the Russian Snow is just a fascinating read. It's unlike any book you will read because Michelle Carter was at the center of a fascinating kind of experiment. What frame of reference these people were? Did they study journalism outside of Russia?
Some did. The people that I worked with were bringing Russian journalists to seminars and so forth in Western Europe. These people they were exposed to it. I wasn't speaking a foreign language. We often joke that there's English, there's Russian, and then there's journalism. And
that's absolutely true. That's not a joke. I get it. Yeah.
But they had been exposed to it. They just needed to learn how to practice it.
Yeah.
And that was my role. Very practical. I didn't come to give the "you people should" speech. Mine was here are some techniques that work for us. They may work for you. I was a cross pollinator. I went to Khabarovsk and Novosibirsk in Siberia, and they told me things that worked for them, and I carried them to the Urals and to Astrakhan. This is a huge country, and so cross pollination was my my best gift, I think.
Michelle Carter, you sound like a fascinating person. I sense that in reading your book, From Under the Russian Snow, and I'm getting a punctuation for those feelings by just talking to you. We have to take a little commercial break, and then we'll continue on for the rest of this half hour. Again, Michelle Carter's book is titled From Under the Russian Snow. It is about her a little more than a year-long intellectual and practical adventure in trying to make a free press out of that repressed country. We'll be right back. Welcome back. We are talking on the telephone from California with Michelle Carter, the author of a riveting memoir titled From Under the Russian Snow, which details a year that she spent in 1995 in Russia trying to instill in various newspapers and newspaper editors the notion of freedom of the press as it had never existed in that country and exists here less and less. Now we're in Michelle, you and I could probably spend 8 hours talking about what's happening in the United States and the whole notion of fake news and the whole Russian probe, but we'll not do that. What prompted you? I know that in many ways this was a difficult book to write because it also deals with the death of your husband of 28 years while you were away, which is certainly a life-shattering and life-altering. But you did some writing for the San Mateo paper while you were on this excursion in Russia, and you continued as a journalist. What was the catalyst that brought you the courage to sit down and say, you know what, I'm going to detail that year in my life because it did change my life. What was there a catalyst for that?
There was. There was one specific moment Thanksgiving, 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We're sitting at the holiday table, and my daughter says, out of the blue, you know, I never understood why you went back after Dad died.
Wow.
And then my son chimes in and says, well, I didn't either. And it occurred to me that I had not done a very good job of explaining to my kids why I was 10,000 miles away when their dad died.
Yeah.
And it, so this book, which I started writing in January after the holidays that very same year, I just wrote for 6 months solid, is my letter to my kids. It's explaining what I was doing on this personal adventure when their dad died.
Yeah, I think that that is the thing that elevates this into, you do call it a memoir. It is filled with, I think, first-rate reportage of what you did over there, but it is also intensely personal. And that is, as you know, I'm a newspaper man too, that is territory we journalists don't often get into. And I think you pulled it off remarkably in From Under the Russian Snow. I have to assume, just hearing you on the telephone and having read you and just knowing what it's like to be a journalist, that you have done a lot of speaking engagements in support of this book. Is that, am I making the right assumption?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's true. Probably more maybe than I
What do you mean more? That's how you sell books these days, Michelle. That's how you sell books. What has been the reception for the book? Because
it has been remarkable.
Yeah.
I first was ventured into the arena of marketing in tiptoeing all the way.
Sure.
And I feel as though I fell into an embrace. Everybody has been terrific. I felt the reception has been amazing. I've had really good comments about from both levels, as a political reportage and also as a personal story. But the you know, writing a memoir, Mary Carr, the great memoirist,
writing a memoir is
like dancing down Broadway with no clothes on. Well, it's true.
It sure is. It sure is. That's the one thing that's kept me away from even attempting anything close to memoir. The book, in many ways, had to be kind of personally and emotionally empowering for you. What did your son and daughter think of this? Did it answer those Thanksgiving evening questions for them?
They both were participants in the producing this. My daughter is a short story writer, published in many, many, many places. She was the best editor I ever had. She saw every piece of it as I was writing, and you know, it was a Word document. She tracked changes, and I'd be reading her comments, and it would, you know, all of a sudden there's one that says, "This is crap," and then I knew that I had work to do.
Spoken
and,
like the true child of a journalist, yeah, in the old-fashioned newsrooms that we probably grew up in, Michelle. What was it that drew you to journalism in the first place?
Oh, I'm a nosy person. Yeah. I dearly love the opportunity to ask questions and have people answer them. I've never found a lid I didn't want to lift up or a door I didn't want to walk through. So this is perfect. It's the perfect job for me.
You must have the many people you encounter, the journalists you encountered in your time in Russia, and as captured in From Under the Russian Snow. You obviously kept in touch with many of those people. And also share their disappointment in what happened to the shackles that were eventually placed on what should have been journalistic freedom there. How painful was that for you?
It's still going on.
Yeah.
I'm in constant contact with a number of the people that I worked with. Also on Facebook, I've reconnected with many people that that I worked with. It's one reason why I never changed my email address.
Sure.
Because out of the blue, I hear from them. But it is painful. It is sad. And it's Facebook has very much become my lens into the politics in Russia. But I'm going back in May as part of the book tour, returning to Moscow and St. Petersburg. And there's going to be a reunion in St. Petersburg of a number of the people that I worked with during that time. So
are many of them
firsthand.
Will you do me a huge favor and keep in touch with me? Because I'd love to have you on the show after you return from that trip to see what that trip was like, to get your...
Absolutely.
It'd be fantastic for me, too. It'd be to have firsthand observations over there. Did most of the people you know and people you're in contact with, did they remain in journalism, or were they so beaten up that they've escaped to less savory professions?
Well, they certainly a number of people have emigrated. I mean, Russia rivals Afghanistan for the most dangerous place to practice journalism in the world.
Yep.
And but there are those who have done magnificent work and continue to do magnificent work. So we just have to celebrate them, and we have to lift them up and shine light on the good work that's still going on.
Well, and also,
and we can do that.
And also to appreciate the and I don't throw this word around lightly, the courage and heroism that it takes to do that very thing that we sometimes, Donald Trump or no Donald Trump, take for granted here.
It is the joke of fake news.
Yeah.
Is it reverberates in my head every time I read a post about somebody else, some newspaper office getting firebombed, death threats to other journalists. It's painful.
Michelle, I am so I am pleased beyond words to have read From Under the Russian Snow, and equally pleased to have talked to you tonight. And let's keep in touch, and I'd love to talk to you on the air when you return from your trip to Russia. It'll be a class reunion of a very interesting and unique class. So I would love to do that. You people can just look for From Under the Russian Snow. It's a fascinating and very personal, but also very insightful about a country we should know more about. Michelle, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
And a pleasure to read you. And I'll talk to you in May.
I'm gonna love you like nobody's loved you, come rain.
That's what it was like to be in Carnegie Hall, I guess, when Judy Garland was doing her famous concert there. And John Zos has always been a dear and smart person, as I have known her. She's had a career at this radio station. She has just recently published, and I've been hearing about this book for a long time. And how's it to be back at the station? You're back here all the time. You're on with Bill and Wendy. One of the great things about having been a producer here, if you then do go out and write a book, everybody will have you on. I'm just glad the book is really... I'd have you on if the book was junk, but the book is really charming.
I'm so relieved that you said that, because when you came in, and I came in, you said, the book is charming. And I was like, thank God, because I know you would fake it.
I would. I wouldn't have had you on. I'd say, oh, I can't get you on. I can't get you on.
Yeah.
Take me back. You're as we've talked on the air before, you're a child of Woodstock, and it's so funny that at 10:30 I'm having Rick Belairs on to talk about Groundhog Day in Woodstock. You then went to Yale to study what and to do what?
I thought I was going to be pre-med. And in fact, I think that's why they took me, because they needed women in science.
Yeah.
And I think they really needed women from small towns in the center of the country in science. And I got there and I spent the first semester studying science, and then I called my dad and I said, I gotta switch.
Yeah.
So So, and it didn't help that I was in a singing group and doing theater and all of that. So,
sure.
But I switched over to English and theater. Which
you've always had, though. I mean, you've always had this sort of artistic, creative bent, have you not?
Yes, I loved performing. I loved music, and I really loved. Part of it, my dad was such a fan of that sort of stuff, so I loved just sort of being what I thought he wanted.
You got out of Yale, and then shortly thereafter started a career, so to speak, at WGN.
Yep, so I got out, I sent a note, I was a professional actress for a minute, and sent letters to Kathy and Judy, Roy Leonard, the intern coordinator, Steve Bertrand. I sent them all letters saying that I wanted to get out of theater and into radio. And every one of them walked into the intern coordinator. The intern coordinator called me and he pretended to be crying. He's like, "Oh, I'm so sorry for you. You had this terrible life in theater." But then he hired me. And
who was the intern coordinator?
Dan Filato.
Oh, my God. I knew Dan. Yeah. I can see Dan thinking that is just hysterical.
Yes. Hilarious.
Dan, if you're listening, yeah.
Yeah. But so then I worked as an intern, but then Bob Collins, producer, got pregnant. And so he had me fill in for her. So I was 23 years old doing the morning show with Bob Collins. It was a dream.
What did you think of it? You also worked for Roy. I mean,
yes.
You worked for some really good, big talents, as they say, and terrific human beings,
yes.
Too. It would be very seductive for a 23-year-old to say, man, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
And I thought I did. We were making $18,000 a year, so
yeah, right,
you know,
right.
That was not wasn't feasible to stay that way. But yeah. But I had no idea how good it was. I thought the rest of life was that good too.
Right,
so I was like,
right.
I went back to grad school for journalism, and I just thought I'd just continue to ascend, and had no idea that WGN was like a Camelot or a Brigadoon.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure. You're right.
No place like it. No place as supportive. No place as family focused.
And it's distinctive. I mean, this you know, that whole hometown voices thing that they used as a marketing tool is true. There's no other station quite like this in the country.
Nothing like it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that whole fence post of conversation or the original social media. I had lunch with Steve Cochran the other day, and I said that they should get billboards saying WGN, the other voices in your head. Because I feel
like it's schizophrenic
always there.
Station. Yeah. Schizophrenia. Then did you give it up? What happened there?
So I went into TV journalism and did a lot of TV, and then started teaching at Northwestern because
teaching what?
Journalism. So
what level?
It
what
was
kind of journalism.
It was broadcast journalism at the graduate school level, and then when I was pregnant with my oldest, I was working for the Weather Channel and for National Geographic and all these other places, and I decided I couldn't travel as much anymore, so I went full time at Northwestern, and. Again, my husband's like, "Why did you leave? Why did you leave?" Because it would be a real cush job to have Northwestern, you know, because Northwestern then does some tuition reimbursement as the kids get older.
Sure, yeah, sure, sure.
But Cochran called a couple of years ago and said, "I'm coming back to GN. I want you to launch my show."
Yeah.
And it was so alluring to get back.
Well, and also so flattering.
Yes,
I mean, that
totally.
To have that level of respect.
Yes.
Because Steve could have gotten.
He could have gotten
anybody. He's got a morning man on WGN, for goodness sake.
Right. I have no idea why he called, but he we're very good friends. So
sure.
Came back and loved it. But then again, you know, and I think I didn't put any of that in the book because it's too topical. But
yeah.
The girls were little. And at one point, my 5-year-old said that she had to pretend to love me because I wasn't there to brush her hair in the morning. And it kind of hurt my heart. So
yeah,
I switched to middays with Bob and Marianne,
mm-hmm.
and launched the business lunch, which was, I think is one of my favorite shows on the station. It's just,
well, Steve's a good guy.
He's such
too.
A good guy.
He's
yeah.
such a good guy.
And so smart and funny. So, but then when Bob and Marianne went away, I had to figure out what I was doing next. And I'd been threatening to do this book. So I put my money where my mouth is.
The book, and that's a big dive, to dive from the precarious radio business into the even more precarious waters of the publishing business is really something. Your daughters are named Sophie and Hannah. Sophie's 11. Hannah is 8, 9.
Just turned 9, yep.
Just turned 9. They have been giving you material since they were both little girls,
right,
material that you decided for some reason. I mean, I have a daughter, too, and I don't think I ever wrote down anything that Fiona said. I used to love it when she would call me Daddy Rick, and that vanished maybe when she was about five. And I don't need to write that down. But you did. Was it couldn't be a journalistic kind of thing. It's a more romantic kind of thing. Why would you write down what they said?
So I think it was the convergence of Facebook and iPhone that really led to it, because people were posting things on Facebook. My kids have not been alive without the iPhone, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I had an iPhone when the little notes thing, and I would just type it when they'd say something funny. I'd laugh out loud. I'd type it, you know, and kind of, and then just file it away.
Yeah.
But then when something was really funny, I was like, oh, I got to share that with my friends. And then they continued to be pretty funny because they had terrible speech impediments, so I could never understand them.
Yeah.
So I was always, it was all of the humor, I hope, in the book is at my expense, because
much of it is.
Yeah.
No question about that. And that's one of the great charms of the book. In doing that, when did it occur to you that you either had enough material for a book or that this material should be in a book?
People on Facebook would say there should be a book, there should be a book, there should be a book, right? And, you know, of course, easier said than done.
Yeah.
And I have probably 700 pages of stuff, that the little vignettes between me and the girls and the husband, who just is named husband. It wasn't, when I found myself sort of at this crossroads, I was like, well, why don't I shop this around? And, you know, I must have sent 150 query letters, revamping my pitch, trying to get someone to be interested. Lots of people were interested. Everyone wanted to change it. So finally, there's this group called She Writes Press, which is actually Deb Siegel is a local author here, and she started that. But the one next to it, or an imprint of that, is Spark Press, and that is a
Press. Out of Arizona.
Yes, and yeah. they don't just do women fiction or memoir or storytelling. They are more commercial. So I sent a sample to them, and they sent back notes, and they liked it. So I was like, okay.
Well, it's irresistible. But before you did that, you told your husband about this.
Yeah.
But when you're telling two little girls that, I think Fiona would have stabbed me if I said, you know, hey, honey, some of the things that you said that are really funny for the last 8 years of your life, I'm going to put in a book. She might have gone insane. What was the reaction of the girls?
Well,
and how did you explain it, Ann Johnsos? How did you explain it to the girls?
I had long been sort of reading them the posts later, you know, because these posts just sort of keep coming. So
yeah,
and
sure.
They thought, as they got to understand that they were funny and that they were creating some joy, they really started to enjoy it. And then when this became an actual manuscript, we went through it together. And
did
I said,
the whole family?
Yeah. And I said, is this one okay? Is that one okay? And there was one that I've talked about before where I was particularly in my head, I was kind of mean. It was my oldest was playing violin, and she asked what was wrong with my eyebrows, and I said over plucking, and she was like, you pluck your eyebrows like I pluck my violin, and I was like, yeah. And then she said, do your eyebrows make music? And my thought was like, does your violin make music? Because I'm not sure it does, right?
Yeah, right.
She
right,
read
right.
that, and she was like, you can't put that out there. No, because people won't like you. And so,
they won't like you.
Yeah.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah, it was very sweet. Yeah. So,
well, there's a lengthy tradition of this kind of thing, and I'm not even going to bring up Art Linklater and Bill Cosby for, you know, the kids say funny things. This is a lot, I think. It is terribly amusing, I think, but it's a lot deeper, too, I think, Anne. I think it's a very meaningful kind of book that resonates and will resonate with anybody who has kids. We'll take a little break and continue on with the former producer. What do you think of Lisa's producing skills?
She's exceptional.
Top of the game. We'll carry on. Again, the book is Potty Mouth, Big Thoughts from Little Brains. It has the feeling, to me, of a series. as long as the girls keep talking. We'll be right back.
Nearer than my head is to the pillow, nearer than the wind is.
I'm playing selections from Judy Garland live at Carnegie Hall, one of the most famous albums ever made. And I'm talking with Ann Johnsos, the former legendary producer at WGN and now the author of what I believe will be the first in a series of books. I don't know if they'll all be titled this, The Potty Mouth. I do think they should be titled Big Thoughts from Little Brains. Here's one, for example. And it's not just about kids. It's about, here's a very interesting, very telling one. And all of these are illustrated by using a pseudonym, some fellow using the pseudonym John Britton, who is a very nice illustrator. He's whoever he is and whatever he does, he's very good. And he's captured this in a very playfully charming way. Here's one, and it's just a little page, and it's just an observation, and this comes from the mom. I am watching daughters play cleaning lady in our hotel room and wondering why this doesn't happen at home. That must resonate with every single parent.
I know. What the heck? They're cleaning the hotel room? And I almost didn't put that one in because I thought it was so mundane. So I'm glad you liked that one.
I do. Another one. This is a fascinating one about which you can. This is why I'm saying to you folks out there, the book is wildly amusing. You can get through it in an hour. And linger on some, and you can get through it in an hour. But some will resonate with you. This one is fascinating. And Anne and her husband's daughters are 11 and just turned 9, but when they were 5 and 7, under the title Corporate Kids, Anne writes, the 5-year-old and 7-year-old have started referring to themselves as Dan and Bob. I want to ask them if they work in accounting. There is something marvelous. I mean, you could write a short story based on that one observation. Could you possibly tell me, do you know why they were calling themselves Dan and Bob?
I have no idea. And they also, later years, the little one starts referring to her biceps as Bob and Larry, and she kisses them.
Bob and Larry. Yeah. Wow. here's another one under decision making. And this, too, has a great amount of depth to it. And this is the mom writing. I am always amused when the 4-year-old and 6-year-old treat eeny, meeny, miny, and moe with the same reverence as, say, the scientific method. You know, the other thing, Anne, that this tells me about is you are a very careful and loving observer of your children. You were you came back to the kids after some producing stuff. You consider yourself a very hands-on mom, do you not?
Yes, and it's funny, after I came back for a while, the older daughter, who was then probably 9, said to me, are you ever going back to work? And I said, yes. And the older one was like, yeah, because she really wanted someone with an identity, right?
Yeah.
And I said, but not right away. And the little one says, yeah. Because she liked having someone at home.
Here's another one under Harbinger. Very rarely does good news follow these words. Mama, I have something to tell you. You do right. You capture the way in which the way in which children talk. Was that important for you to do phonetically? And why?
It was important to me. So some of the people who looked at the early versions of the book said I had to cut that out. But
yeah.
So many of the moments in the book are when I can't understand what they're saying. And that's because they did have, like, there's one bit where the little one is asking if she's Guamuis. And my response is, no, you have 2 grandmas and a step grandma. And she's like, my friends say I'm Guamuis. And I say, why would anyone say that? And she says, my sparkly shoes. And she was saying glamorous, yeah. But I couldn't understand her, right? So
I thought
that was part of it. I also think that the people who are close to me, there's a little bit of work when you read this, because you have to sort of put yourself through.
But Anne, a very little bit of work. If anybody thinks, oh, my good. Well, and to that point, I'm going to read Patience. This is page 111. Earlier today, I watched the four-year-old flip through 318 pages, one at a time, with consideration for each, of a German dictionary. Then she got to the start of the H section and said, "Ah, H. Her name begins with H." That's one of the most charming, because you can visualize the entire thing taking place.
And I think part of that one is funny, because I had no idea what the heck she was doing. I was just like, what is she doing with the German dictionary? And she was seriously just looking for that letter.
I find that beyond charming. The last one I'll read is, because a lot of these are observations of yours, too.
Right.
And probably some of your husband's maybe put in your mouth. But first sniff is free. I think Windex might be a gateway drug. Every time I clean the kitchen, the five-year-old sneaks in to sniff the countertops. It is a charming, charming book, Ann Johnsos. Your creativity has taken a new road here. Potty Mouth, Big Thoughts for Little Brains. You can buy it anywhere where books are sold. What you should do is go to your neighborhood bookstore, because they still do have neighborhood bookstores, and you can go in there and say, hey, order, hey, bookseller, hey.
Well, I'm going to be at the bookseller February 10th doing a reading.
Oh, so fantastic.
If anybody wants to get a copy, and you don't have to, but if anyone wants to, I'll be there 6 o'clock on February 10th. And that's right in Lincoln Square.
It's a great store.
Yeah, love it.
In Lincoln Square, if you've never been there, it's just a charming, it's the only mall I've ever seen that has worked, an urban mall that's worked out correctly. And the bookseller's a charming store. Oh, that's neat. You're doing a live reading. Are the girls going to be there?
They are.
They come to some before?
Yeah, you and I were talking about Read Between the Lines and Eileen Lines and Woodstock.
The great book sign, yeah.
And I didn't know what to expect, because I had never done a book signing. So I got there, and people in the audience, who are people I know mostly, they asked the girls to read. And the girls picked out their favorite pages, and it was very funny. They liked all the bath time ones. I have no idea.
Well, in the world of book marketing that is changing radically, there's nothing better than to have two cute little girls, 11 and 9 years old, helping you promote and sell your book. And this is obviously, I said, it has the feel of a series.
I have the material, and I actually think that the next installation is better, because they get smarter and funnier, the girls,
and more,
do.
And more worldly.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So if I can, you and I were talking off the air that writing the book is not difficult. It's the marketing of the book.
Oh, absolutely.
And that has been a huge lesson to me. So, you know, if I can survive this sort of will you like me phase of life, there will be another one.
Well, I think the bookseller in Heart of Lincoln Square, when is that, February what?
February 10th at 6 o'clock.
Come and meet Ann Johnsos and her two little girls. Maybe your husband will be lurking in the back. The book, again, is Potty Mouth, Big Thoughts Form Little Brains. It's a good thing you didn't go into medicine, because I think you're going to have a very creative career.
Thank you, Rick.
It's a great book. Charming.
Thank
just
you so
charming.
Much.
I was a stranger in the city, out of town were the people I knew.
Thank you, Aubrey. That's Judy Garland singing. Save that song for the very end of the show. I want to play the whole song. That's Judy Garland at the Carnegie Hall. Carnegie Hall is, of course, in Manhattan, and across the river from Manhattan is New Jersey, and New Jersey is the setting for what I have to call an astonishing novel. It's called Us Kids Know by J.J. Strong. J.J., how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Is that too much? Astonishing? Too much for you to deal with as
it's a bit
critical much, response to your work. Full disclosure, JJ is married to a woman, Via, who I have known since she was a child. He has the burden of having as his father-in-law one of my dearest friends on the planet, Charles Osgood, who is, you let him take care of your children, JJ?
Well, you know, we have,
you have no choice.
6 weeks old.
You have no choice.
I would take anybody who shows up at my door.
You know, this novel is sort of, and I know the whole, even getting a novel published these days is one of the grand accomplishments in all creative arts. But it is, I must tell you, I was slightly reluctant to read it at first. I would have read it simply because of who you are. The pigeonholed as a young adult fiction, young adult puts me off. This book has nothing. It's about teenagers, but it's not. You know what I mean? That kind of pigeonholing. Are you okay with that? And is that just the nature of publishing these days?
It is, and I am okay with it. I mean, I don't have much say in the matter as much
as no kidding.
The higher ups do.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, it's a funny thing. I wrote the book somewhat naively, not really thinking about marketing or genre or audience. You know, I was just thinking I'm going to write a book about these teenagers.
Yeah.
And then I submitted it to an agent who signed with me, and he said, I think this is a YA novel. And I said, okay, well,
if you're
you going to, I'm very smart. I'm a real writer. So
yeah,
let's rethink this.
And
I feel really embarrassed about that now. Cause I think there's a lot of actually great, incredible work being done, in the young adult market.
There's no question. I despise the sort of categorization of this in the same way that, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird was at one point would now be seen as a young adult novel. The book, you've got a degree from Georgetown in English and a creative writing degree from USC, and you've taught some creative writing. This is your first published work. I have to imagine it is not the first book that you sat down to try to write.
It's not. It's my second, actually. My first was the thesis that I wrote in grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, I like to say that one was sort of, the synopsis was, I'm 24 and I feel weird. It was a lot of...
Carry on, and carry on for 350 pages, yeah.
Right, exactly. Although, you know, Lena Dunham is a millionaire off that exact concept, so
No kidding. When you write, I don't want to get too deeply into your creative process, because I want to talk about these three kids. Actually, there are four kids, and it's centered on the lives of three kids, but there's another kid that fascinates me, too. It's sort of, the book is set in the wake of 9/11, focusing on three high school kids, a brother and sister, and a outlier who comes into their lives, who is not a... No one is who they seem to be in this book, and that fascinates me no end. When you decide to write this book, do you outline it? How does your fiction writing creativity work, JJ? It may change in the next 20 years, but what is it like now for you?
Yeah, well, it's even changed. So I'm writing a second book now, or a third book, but it's even changed from Us Kids Know until my current project, because even on Us Kids Know, I was still sort of finding a process.
I
sure.
was
sort of learning how to write. And so for Us Kids Know, I kind of had big plot point. You know, I knew what the halfway point was, and I mapped out, you know, two or three plot points along the way, and I wrote to those points.
Gotcha.
So it wasn't a very detailed outline. Now this book I'm writing now, I have a more detailed outline, but I'm finding, ironically, it doesn't necessarily make things easier. Yeah.
Well, you set up in this book what I think, for a young, certainly first-time novelist, an incredibly challenging narrative to have three distinct voices. The book is told in the voices of Bree and her brother Ray, and also their their interesting buddy, so I'll put it, Cullen. That's obviously a conscious effort. How was that for you? Is that because the voices are individualistic and distinctive to me in the book, and they all move the narrative forward? But to come to the page every day and say, okay, today I am Cullen. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How was that?
Yeah, it was challenging at times. I spent a lot of time writing plays as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a playwright, you do that on a much smaller scale.
Sure, sure.
You know, jumping into people's heads. And so I think that helped. I almost looked at each section as a long monologue. And that helped me tap into the voices.
Yeah.
But on any given day, if I had to, if I finished one section and had to jump into another person, that could be challenging.
Yeah. I think it works marvelously well. I'm going to read you, before we take a commercial break, and again, I'm talking to novelist J.J. Strong, the initials J.J. Strong. The novel is Us Kids Know. It's a cool cover, too. Are you happy with the cover?
Yeah, I love the cover.
Yeah, me too. I'm very taken with the cover. I'm going to read you.
I wish I could take credit for it.
Well, no, you can't do everything. You're the writer. I mean,
true.
Your next cover. Wait a minute. Who took this? Did Charlie take this? Wait a minute. Did Charlie take your author shot on the bell? Yes, of course.
Author photo?
But it's worth buying the book to get another photo from Charles Osgood. There it is. Photo by Chuck, now calling himself Chuck Osgood. I want to read you just one paragraph. This is, I'm not even going to tell you who this is, but if you want to get a sense of the, it's a book about high school, and there's some not very nice things that happen later on in the book. But here is a paragraph that JJ, I admire it so much. It captures a real sense of foreboding and potential danger. It is the beginning of one of the chapters. JJ Strong writes, "Shooting the gun felt like a punch to the heart, just like I wanted it to. The guy in Elizabeth had given us a Glock 21. It looked like a cop's pistol, which probably should have made me doubly nervous about getting caught with it, but what actually made me more excited to try it." Man, that is a scary, scary paragraph. We'll be back after a short commercial break with J.J. Strong.
I believe in doing what I can, trying when I must.
That's Judy Garland singing. I'm Rick Kogan, and I'm talking to J.J. Strong. Kind of in celebration of his first of what I am sure will be many published works, whether they are novels or plays. This one is a novel called Us Kids Know. It focuses on three, actually, I think four, young people in New Jersey in the wake of the 9/11 disaster. They all go to private school. It's told in the voice of three different characters. The great thing for me, JJ, is you. It is not just the story of the three kids. It is also the story, somewhat tragic story, of the parents of the three kids. Tell me about, in your words, Ray and Bree, this brother and sister.
Well, Ray is a freshman. He's 15, just starting a new private school. And his sister is his older sister. She's a junior. And they're sort of adrift, mm-hmm. and mostly because of their somewhat lacking parental situation. Their mother suffers from severe depression. And so they both, especially Bree, but they both are sort of waiting and hoping and yearning for their mother to break out of it and sort of be a mother to them. And part of a lot of what they realize is that that's not going to happen. And their father is a psychiatrist who sort of gets wrapped up in helping first responders in post 9/11,
right,
which is obviously an honorable goal, but he does.
But it's also a kind of way. It's kind of a way of his being able to be in kind of denial about the chaos in his own household. Yes.
Right. Yeah. It's
or a defense mechanism or something. Yeah.
Right. It's like he can fix all these strangers or attend to all these strangers' problems, but not the ones in his own home. And that has a pretty serious effect on the kids.
And, you know, the thing, you know, Ray is kind of picked on and Bree is kind of doing her utmost to try to fit in. And then the whole having gone to a private school, not a Catholic school, it really resonated with me the ways in which especially she was trying to fit in. Then they meet he may seem at first kind of the classic bad boy, Cullen Hickson, who also has some troubles of his own at home, yes?
Yeah, so Cullen, he is sort of, his most easily identifiable trait is that he's, like, preternaturally gifted at delinquency.
Yes.
and he uses that to his advantage, actually, quite well. But he, like you said, you know, behind the scenes, he's also kind of struggling. Both of his parents died, and he was mostly raised by his grandmother, who, at this point, nobody really has checked in on them, but she's sort of too old to care for him, so he's really caring for her, which, again, you know, it's sort of like he's been asked in that capacity to grow up too soon.
The thing with Cullen is he is seductive, I think, in two vastly different ways. He's seductive to Bree in a kind of adolescently sexual way, and to Ray in a more criminal way or delinquent way. I'm going to say in a sort of criminal, pushing the boundaries kind of way. Is that? The thing you really capture, J.J. Strong, is the sort of sexual exploration that Cullen and Bree undertake. There's one scene on a couch that just, I wish I could read that, but it might be shocking to GN listeners, but it's really, really, it's really well done. Am I right about that? I mean, he is seductive in ways that the two of them are relatively easily seduced, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I think all three of the characters are harbor some sort of anger, and I think that at their circumstances, you know, and I think that sure. Bree and Ray see in Cullen somebody who has found an outlet for his anger, and that seems seductive to both of them in different ways.
What about the other character that really intrigues me is Ray's friend Ari. Talk to me about him for a second, or for a minute.
Sure. Well, yeah, Amir is a Saudi Arabian Muslim student at this private Catholic high school, so he also gets bullied even more so than Ray.
Yeah.
And he and Ray sort of form a bond, maybe because of that their sort of outcast status. I see the book as a four-character book, even though he doesn't get his own narrative sections.
Right, I, as do I. I think he's a very, very strong character. There are a lot of strong characters in this book. I'm going to read... I'm not going to tell people where this is in the book, but you want to be haunted. You want to be haunted by a paragraph. Here is a paragraph for you, ladies and gentlemen, written by J.J. Strong in the book Us Kids Know. I hadn't looked in a mirror all day. There was no telling what I looked like, but it couldn't have been pretty. No one comes back from the dead fully healed. Dad didn't offer much of a reaction, though, and I had the thought that maybe it was so dark out here he couldn't even see me. I shivered and kicked dirt off my shoes. My legs wouldn't stop shaking. I put one hand in my jacket pocket, wrapped the other around the doorknob, and pulled. The wind still beating and clamoring outside. I stepped into the light and shut the door. That J.J. Strong, I must tell you, as someone who's read thousands of books, is really, really good writing. How do you labor over a paragraph like that? Or does something like that, and we both know where the paragraph sits in the book, does it come fast to you, or do you have to labor over something like that? I just think it's a beautifully written paragraph.
Yeah, I wish I remember writing that exact one.
Yeah.
Because I think it, I mean, you know, as a writer, it depends on any given day. Like sometimes the muses come down and they crown your head in laurel and you just write pure gold. And other times you can labor over a sentence for hours and change to the, you know, back and forth and endlessly. So, that section actually sort of appeared in different forms throughout the book.
Yeah.
And it ended up where it did.
Where it did, sure. I get it.
But I guess the emotion behind it came pretty easily, but I remember tinkering with those sentences
I can only imagine. It's just great writing. J.J., it has really been a thrill for me to read your first novel, irrespective of your familial ties and your idiocy of letting Charles Osgood babysit your babies. But I hope to see you in person one of these days, and I certainly hope to read more of you. This book, J.J. Strong, the initials J.J. and Strong, Us Kids Know, beautiful cover. Lise Graham, the producer, is going to read it next, and she will become a fan, too. Love to the family, J.J., and congratulations. I can't wait for more.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks,
take care of yourself.
Appreciate
my pleasure.
When you smile at me, I heard a melody. It haunted me from the start.
It's a great double CD. Judy Garland live at Carnegie Hall. Highlight of her career, her amazing career. One of my favorite places on the planet. I love Paris. I like New York, but... you know, given my druthers, I'd really just drive out to Woodstock and hang out in Woodstock. I love Woodstock, Illinois, and the leading expert. I know you're going to blanch at that, Rick Belairs. My leading expert and my connection with Woodstock is my friend Rick Belairs, who lives there, who has lived there for some time, and who sells properties out there. Rick, how are you?
I'm good, Rick. How are you?
You love Woodstock, too. There are a million reasons to love Woodstock, aren't there?
I do. It's a great town. It's just, you know, it's charming.
Well, it is charming, and I think, you know, I think just because you have to drive, you know, those 25 minutes or whatever it is on 47 to get there, it is retained. It hasn't been blighted by the urban sprawl that has kind of, you know, homogenized a lot of other suburbs around here. You and I are of an age when we saw, you know, you drive to downtown Highland Park now, it looks like downtown Chicago, for goodness sake. Woodstock's retained that old world charm. Why do you think, Rick?
I think it's probably that we're just far enough removed. We're just kind of at the fringe of maybe a decent commute. And so, yeah, the sprawl hasn't really gotten here. And the forefathers 150 years ago, when they laid out Woodstock with the park in the center of town, the town square.
Yeah.
And then they add the old McHenry County Courthouse, the red brick building. And then you've got the beautiful Woodstock Opera House. It just, in any season, this right now with all the Christmas lights lit around the square is beautiful. In the spring, when the flowers, the trees are blossoming, in the fall, when the trees, the maples turn red, it's just a glorious little town. I mean, the town square is the heart of the town.
Yeah, no question. And you, and in the summer, as you know, and you've told me a million times, the gazebo out there, they have concerts there and all sorts of other things there. How long, remind me, Rick Bellairs, how long you've lived there? Because I know you were young enough to be in the original, to be a have a what I will always think of now that I know where you are in it, a prominent role in the movie Groundhog Day.
My dad left WBBM in 1969 and bought the local radio station out here. So we moved out here in 1969. I was gone for half of the 80s and lived in Japan and then came back. So most of my life has been here in Woodstock.
Yeah. And I think you're right about that. It is the nature of that town square that has so many lovely businesses, like Between the Lines bookstore and all that stuff. But was it 25 years ago? When did Groundhog Day come out, the movie?
This is the 25th anniversary of the release. They actually filmed it in 1992, but it came out in 93. So this is the 25th anniversary of the movie Groundhog Day.
And what did that do for the town, Rick Bellairs? And it didn't, you know, in many ways, it didn't ruin the town at all. Do you know what I mean? Not at all. It was fun.
No. It was funny because in back then, in 1992, this is a long time ago,
yeah.
There were some merchants on the town square that were opposed to Columbia Pictures coming in and taking over and blocking streets, that this was going to take away parking for their customer. It was going to block access to their stores. It was going to cost them their livelihood and be bad for business.
Short-sighted is what we call those kinds of people.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
The state police, yeah. So the production company ended up, you know, making things right with those who complained, and production went on. And, in fact, it drew people to town even back then, people coming to watch the filming, whether they were doing day scenes or they were setting up and doing night scenes. And people would come and stand on street corners and you know, looking across the street, watch the filming.
Yeah.
So it had this draw right from the beginning in 1992. A couple years, maybe even as soon as the next year, somebody decided, well, if they made a movie called Groundhog Day here, we should celebrate it. Mm-hmm. So the first year there was, you know, 20 people got together on Groundhog Day and celebrated.
Were you among them?
No, I wasn't.
What?
I was one of the extras in the movie, but I didn't have any real connection for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just hadn't gotten involved to that extent.
Well, one of the great things is the Groundhog Day, you know, I know they do the thing in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. I guess that's where they do it. But to my mind, the Groundhog Day in Woodstock has become... every year, Rick Bellairs, it seems to get larger and larger and more, and also not just commercially so, but I think, and you can address this better than I, creatively so too, yes?
We tend to go with the theme of the movie and repeat things over and over again. But, you know, what I think is funny is that as the popularity, the following for the movie Groundhog Day has grown extensively over the years, I think many people today, when they think of Groundhog Day, the image they have in their mind is actually Woodstock.
Yeah.
They think they're seeing Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, but what people think of for Groundhog Day is the movie.
Yeah.
And that's all, you know, it was all filmed right here in Woodstock. They were here for 3 months or better filming, and almost every scene was shot right in Woodstock. And we even, Harold Ramis came back for, I believe it was the 5th anniversary. Stephen Tobolowsky came for the 10th anniversary. They didn't have to come.
Right.
The town struck a chord with those people in the movie. A few years ago, Danny Rubin, who wrote the story, came. And it just has drawn some of those people to come back because they were set up in town for so long, they kind of grew to bond with the community.
Well, I mean, they fell in love with Woodstock the same way I've fallen in love with Woodstock. We're going to talk more with Rick. Hey, did somebody buy the Bill Murray, what I always call the Bill Murray house? Did someone buy that?
Right? A bed and breakfast, yes.
Yes.
We spoke about that a year or a couple ago, but yes, it has new owners, so we can talk about that.
Oh, fantastic. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the musical that Danny Rubin was involved in that you saw in New York, and I thought this was going to be, you know, the next Hair, or not quite the next Hamilton, that from everything I'd heard about it, that it was going to be a huge smash. It may still be, but it didn't seem to capture. You loved it, did you not, when you saw it?
I am totally biased, and admittedly so, and I did love it.
A lot of critics did. I mean, I still don't know quite what happened. We're going to talk a lot of things. I'm on the phone with my pal Rick Belairs. Rick, how can people get in touch with you? Because I think people, you know, Woodstock would certainly be a lovely place to live, and that's, you're in the business of selling places to live out there. I suppose you sell commercial businesses too. But how do people get in touch with you?
815-334-2618 is my number. Mm-hmm. If people want information and the schedule for Groundhog Day, that's
groundhogday.org. I've got that. I'll tell them that. We got to take a short commercial break, and we'll be back with Rick Belairs talking about the joys and the fun of a Woodstock, Illinois. Do yourself a favor and pick up Judy Garland live at Carnegie Hall. I'm sure you can get it in a million different ways. I, of course, have it on CD. I'm talking with Rick Belairs, my friend, the son of the late, great Mel Belairs, who many of you may remember. He sells homes and properties in Woodstock, but he loves Woodstock. Woodstock's his home. Now, Rick, did you sell the bed and breakfast? Was that your property?
No, I wasn't, but it's a great story.
Yeah.
There was a retiring high school teacher, the chorus teacher, and many of his students were coming back for this grand celebration. His students from over the years were coming back for, you know, the send-off party for this teacher who had taught for many years at Woodstock High School. And there was a couple here from Florida, and they were staying at the B&B, and they said, "Oh, this place is lovely. If you ever want to sell it." And the owner was like, "Well, okay."
Yeah, we've been trying to do that for years. Yeah.
So they put together this deal over breakfast and a cup of coffee, and these people were just in town on a fluke event and had no intention, and there you have it, new owners of, it's now the, they changed the name, it's the Cherry Tree Inn B&B, and so we got new owners, and they're opening up the house. We, as part of the Groundhog Day festivities, have walking tours around town.
Sure.
You can go sit at the bar where Bill Murray and Andy McDowell drink to world peace. You can go to the bowling alley where Bill Murray sits with his friends and debates whether his glass is half full or half empty. Well, our walking tour always walks out to the bed and breakfast where Bill Murray stayed and woke every morning and started the day over and over again. With
listening to Sonny and Cher. Yep, yep.
Well, our tour used to just end up on the sidewalk out in front looking at the building. Well, the new owner said, "That's silly. It's cold out there. Come inside." So she's going to serve up some hot cider and invite people in to see the bed and breakfast from the inside.
Oh, how fabulous. That is such such a charming story, Rick. That is, and it goes to the heart of, you know, what Woodstock is, I think, this incredibly charming town. Let's go back for a second to the, and then we'll get all the details about Woodstock Groundhog Day, and you can get some yourself by going to woodstockgroundhog.org. You saw the musical stage version of Groundhog Day in New York, and you really liked it, didn't you?
I actually saw it in London.
Oh, wow.
And They did a warm-up in London, saw it there. Then I saw it twice over the course of 3 or 4 days in New York. It was funny. We were in New York, went to see it. We were supposed to be leaving on, I think it was Monday, to come home. But this huge rainstorm came in. They canceled all the flights in and out of New York, and we were stuck in New York for another day.
Mm.
So when weather forces you to repeat a day and you can't get out of town, what do you do? You go see Groundhog Day again.
And you thought, I mean, and you have some experience, you know, as a film star. You liked it. You thought it was a very substantial show, didn't you?
I did. Danny Rubin, who, as you said, wrote Groundhog Day, worked with Tim Minchin. He did the music for it. Tim Minchin had done, I've lost track of the other musical that he's better known for.
Don't worry about it.
Anyway, they put together a great show, staged really well, very creative sets with rotators and the whole thing. And, I'm very biased, but I thought it was a very clever show. It was pretty true to the movie in most aspects. It had great music, drew lots of laughs, and it just apparently didn't make it. They had planned a longer run in Broadway.
It
didn't succeed. They had planned to take it on the road nationally, and last I heard, the plans for that were off. So
it's too bad, because
really
most of the reviews I read were very positive, but, you know, there's no telling in that, you know, the crazy world of modern day entertainment, what's going to work and what doesn't work. How active?
What's funny is after I was there and had seen it twice in the course of like 3 days, a week or two later, I saw that Bill Murray had gone to see the show.
Right, right.
And he liked it so much, he went back again.
That's right. That was big news. I remember that too, Rick. I remember that too. How involved are you with the Groundhog Day stuff? Are you merely a participant? Or are you one of the organizers? Or how involved are you
these days? I'm afraid at this point I've been pushed up to being the chair of the Woodstock Groundhog Day Committee. So I'm kind of...
Well, it's about time. All I say is it's about time. Well, I know you have... When's the Groundhog come out? What morning is that?
Friday, February 2nd. February 2nd is Groundhog Day. We start our events with a kickoff Thursday evening with the awakening of the Groundhog, where our mascot, Woodstock Willie, makes an appearance with some fanfare on the balcony of the Woodstock Opera House overlooking the square. So that's Thursday night. Then 7 a.m., in the park. It's free, but I just saw the forecast for Friday morning. It looks like it's going to be cold, so don't forget your booties, because it's cold out there. Yep. We will be in the park for the Groundhog festivities. The live Groundhog comes out a little bit after 7, giving us the forecast of whether spring is right around the corner or we have 6 more weeks of winter.
Right. And then there are also movies. And I mean, it just sounds like a pleasant few days of activities, too.
We make it to be just fun. Most of it, as I said, is free or it's civic organizations. We work with the Kiwanis, the Moose, the Rotary, School District 200 for lots of these events. The free showing of the movie where you can see Groundhog Day on the big screen. That's at 10 o'clock Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Well, I mentioned the walking tour around town to see some of the sites. The Woodstock Library has a lot of things that Columbia Pictures left behind after the filming, and they'll have an open house Friday afternoon where you can come in and see some of the set designs and lots of information from back in the filming in 1992. There's a dinner dance Friday night at the Moose, and that's one of the places where some of the filming was done. They filmed the bachelor auction at the Woodstock Moose.
That's right.
So we have a dinner dance there. Saturday, a full day with bowling, the chili cook-off, pub crawl. The holidays are behind us. Spring is still off in the future.
Oh, yeah, and February.
It's in the middle of winter.
Yeah, and February is February. The and it just, if you've never been to Woodstock, is it booked? I mean, I know that people, we've talked before that there are some people, the power of that film has drawn people to Woodstock from, you know, every foreign country imaginable, hasn't it?
We have had people from across the country, and yes, people coming from foreign countries as well. The Groundhog Day bed and breakfast, as I call it, is always booked up very early.
Sure.
A couple of the hotel rooms or hotels in town I checked with recently were approaching capacity. If people are just coming in for the day, we're on the Metra Northwest train line, and as you mentioned, we're about 20 minutes off of Interstate 90.
Yeah.
Fairly easy access.
Oh, it's incredibly easy. And there are, you know, there are some hotels. I mean, there's a Holiday Inn of sorts on 47 as you're going in there. And I think that, depending on the weather, I mean, it's a glorious place to spend a weekend. There's no question about it. And a lot of pressure on you now, my friend, Rick Belairs, being the head of this whole thing?
No, because at this point, we've been doing it so long, and as I said, most of the events just kind of repeat. It's not pressure, it's just fun. See the faces, the expression, on, especially the kids on Groundhog Morning with the expectation of what's to come, and the crowd, they now seem to be coming more and more with their own custom hats with groundhogs on top of their heads and looking out on this as the sun is starting to come up and you're getting daylight and people are jumping up and down a little bit just to keep warm. It's very exciting.
Well, you make it sound so, Rick. It's always great to talk to you. I remember if it was on the radio for print, I interviewed the guy who, like, owns the groundhog, who brings the groundhogs to the thing. It's just some wonderfully homespun thing in this crazy, you know, it's a respite from the trying times, and I think you've captured it perfectly. Rick, it is always a treat to talk to you.
Rick, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
It is always a treat. You too, pal.
Happy Groundhog
Knock 'em
Day.
Dead. Yes. Don't wear a hat. Don't wear a hat. Don't wear a hat. And look for Rick Belairs in the movie the next time you see the movie. Thank you all very much for listening. Thanks to Lise Graham for doing her extraordinary job of producing, even with Ann Johnzos in here, the legendary producer. Aubrey Mumpower, you're a great engineer and a good man.